This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 3 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, coming up on today's programme. The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom delivered a speech this afternoon to members of her governing Conservative Party, in which she sets out her vision for Brexit and the future of the United Kingdom, in a week where Scotland has once again started to threaten a referendum on its own independence from Britain. A controversial new piece of legislation is due to be rolled out across the UK next month without having been voted on in Parliament or being subjected to parliamentary scrutiny. The legislation will require women who conceived a child via rape to prove that they were raped in order to gain access to benefits. An attack on a French school in the southeast of France has once again raised concerns about the availability of guns and explosives in the country. But as a state of emergency continues, should more be done to psychologically profile potential attackers? And it is, of course, St. Patrick's Day, and we'll be looking at some things you might not know about the Irish holiday. All that and more over the next hour on this Friday edition of World in Focus. The UK Prime Minister today gave a much-anticipated speech in the Welsh capital, Cardiff, to members of her own Conservative Party, billed in advance as one in which she would set out her vision for a post-Brexit Britain, as well as the ongoing status of the United Kingdom in the wake of threats from the Scottish Government to pursue an independence referendum. Our very own Jack Foster was watching the speech this afternoon, and he joins me now. Jack, firstly, just what is the significance of this speech?
First of all, Carolyn, may I just say a very happy St. Patrick's Day
to you
and all of
our listeners.
We've obviously had a pre-show Guinness, you know, in the spirit of things. What was the significance of this speech? Well, that could be argued one way or the other. Obviously, this was a speech to the party faithful, to the Conservative Party, Theresa May's own party. And when a governing Prime Minister gives a speech to their own party, there's unlikely to be many people in the room who aren't going to be cheering or who are going to be particularly critical. Secondly, you would probably say that the content wasn't particularly unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, no, I think we could possibly have guessed in advance what the content of Theresa May's speech would have been. And of course, we knew it would cover Brexit and the Scottish question. Were there any surprises?
No, not particularly. I mean, it was... If you were being very critical, you would say there was quite a lot of platitudes and not really much actual information. There wasn't really anything that you hadn't already heard her say before. It kind of felt a little bit like she was really just summing up the week that she's had. And this week has not been a particularly easy one for her. As you know, it began with the Brexit bill being passed. Great news. That means she can trigger Article 50. And then all of a sudden, Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, appeared and upstaged her entirely by saying, well, if you're going to do that, then we're going to want to have an independence referendum in Scotland. So she's been dealing with that all week. She's been trying to sort of firefight the question of whether or not she would grant the permission to the Scottish Parliament to hold another referendum. Now, before we go any further, we're going to hear a few clips from the speech. Don't worry, we're not going to make listeners hear the entire thing. I did that on your behalf earlier on today. First of all, we can hear a little bit of Theresa May now talking about the plan for Brexit.
I want to talk to you about this government's plan for Britain. A plan for Britain that will guide our policies and actions. A plan for Britain that will deliver a stronger, fairer country. For we stand on the threshold of one of the most significant moments Britain has known for many years. During the next 2 weeks, we will trigger Article 50 and begin the negotiations to secure the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union. I choose to believe in Britain and that our best days lie ahead. Because while the road before us may be uncertain at times, I believe, with the British people, that it leads towards a brighter future for our nation's children and grandchildren. The stronger, fairer country we want won't just emerge. It will take effort and focus, discipline and hard work. And above all, it requires that we set out and deliver on a plan.
That was Theresa May, the UK Prime Minister, speaking in the Welsh capital, Cardiff, today at the Spring Conference for her Conservative Party in Wales. So she announced in there nothing particularly new. She said that the Article 50 would be triggered by the end of the month. We already knew that. She said that Britain would be stronger and fairer as a result of Brexit. I guess most people would have hoped for that. She didn't really go into masses more detail into exactly how it would be stronger and fairer, but that has been very much the trademark of the Brexit procedure thus far.
Did she spend more time talking about the fact she was going to be introducing her Brexit plan than actually introducing her Brexit plan? Is that a fair thing to say?
I don't want to sound like a horrific cynic, Carolyn. I wouldn't say that, no. She spent quite a lot of time saying that she was going to, and she spent quite a lot of time explaining how it was going to be very good. She did devote a good section of her speech, in fairness to Theresa May, to talking about the areas in which she wanted to make changes. But the extent to which they were entirely related to Brexit and negotiations with the EU is difficult to say, because a lot of them were internal UK politics as well.
It is a vast area to cover as well. I mean, it's not an easy speech to be writing a speech in which you've said that you're going to outline a plan for Brexit. But did she actually get to talking about the plan and how Brexit would look?
Well, she did. But I think I got the impression, and I imagine a lot of people who were watching the speech will have got the impression, that, and this is a thing that speechwriters for politicians do tend to do, they know that the media will tend to only pull small clips, a soundbite here or there from the speech that they'll show on TV or radio, or that'll be published in newspapers and things. So they make sure that a certain sort of theme keeps recurring, so that if a segment is taken out, then that theme will always come through. Now, you know, call me crazy, but I got the feeling that a stronger and fairer Britain was maybe the phrase that Theresa May's speechwriters were keen to fit into it. And I'll hopefully try and demonstrate that for you now.
A plan to make the most of the opportunities ahead and to build a stronger, fairer Britain that is more united and more outward-looking. That means building a stronger economy. It means creating a fairer society. As we put the values of fairness with a plan to build a stronger economy for all. It's to build a fairer society. It means building a stronger, fairer Britain. And that is the fairer Britain we are building.
So that was Theresa May speaking at the Welsh capital of Cardiff today, the Spring Conference of the Conservative Party in Wales. And I should point out that that was not all of the times that she referred to a stronger, fairer Britain. I didn't go through the entire speech, and you did hear some of it actually in the clip we heard before. Now, I would suspect that supporters of the UK Conservative government would say that we'd maybe been a little unfair there. But it did seem, as I said before, that our speechwriters were keen to get that phrase in there. So you can't really criticise us for not being on message. If anything, we're very much doing what Theresa May and the Conservative Party in the UK probably would have wanted us to do.
It's not exactly a bad theme to have, stronger and fairer, but it...
I would be intrigued to find another politician in Britain who would say, no,
we
want a weaker...
more unequal.
I suspect that wouldn't happen. Well, so what was she talking about when she was talking about a stronger, fairer Britain? She went into detail about various things. The main points in terms of fairness... she seemed to be talking a lot about selective schools, which is effectively people being selected based on their academic ability, which is many people criticise because it creates a sort of two-tier society. She referred to it very much as a meritocracy, about the UK becoming this glorious meritocracy. But she sort of paid lip service as well to the non-selective schools and looking after them as well. But obviously, if all of the... high-achieving students are being peeled off to other schools, they're probably going to have more problems than they had to begin with. She talked about a country that works for the many. She used the phrase hard-working families quite a lot. That was an old favourite of Tony Blair back in the day. And this United Kingdom, which was one that she talked about a lot. That was what she referred to as her overarching theme.
And, well, this United Kingdom, I suppose, brings us, ironically, given the imminent triggering of Article 50 and Brexit, to that Scottish headache facing the Prime Minister, the threat of a renewed independence referendum in Scotland.
Well, it does. And that really was the point that I think most people were watching this speech for, hoping that maybe Theresa May would give a little more clarity with regards to the Scottish situation. To bring people up to speed, the Scottish Government have said that next week they will be, well, provided there's a vote in Parliament, but that's likely to pass in the Scottish Parliament, they will be asking for permission from the UK Government, which they need to seek because it's a devolved Parliament, to hold a second referendum on independence from Britain. Now, that can be denied, obviously, by the UK government, and the UK government are making noises to that effect. However, Theresa May, up until now, has not been explicit about it. Perhaps she will be next week when the Scottish government formally asks permission. But this is what brings us to the longer section of Theresa May's speech, which we're going to let you hear in just a moment. This is a bit more of a substantial piece, which focuses more on what Theresa May said about the UK as a whole and how she envisages the future of the union that is England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And this is obviously just the highlights of it, but I think we can hear that now.
Well, thank you very much, everybody, and it's good to be here in Cardiff today for our Spring Forum and Welsh Conference. Bringing these two events together under one banner reminds us once again that we are and will always be the Conservative and Unionist Party. Yes. The only party today that represents and delivers for every part of this precious United Kingdom, responding to and delivering on the decision of the British people to leave the European Union and embark on a new global role. Our task is clearer still. It is to use this moment of opportunity to shape a brighter future for Britain. It is to use this period of change to step back and ask ourselves what kind of country we want to be. And it is to use the years ahead to deliver an ambitious programme of economic and social reform that prepares Britain for that brighter future and ensures we emerge stronger, fairer, more united and more outward-looking than ever before. Everything I've been talking about today adds up to the overarching goal of our plan for Britain, the creation of a more united nation that our children and grandchildren are proud to call home. Our party believes heart and soul in our United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. The precious bond between four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. But that union is more than just a constitutional artefact. It is a union between all of our citizens, whoever we are and wherever we're from. So our plan for Britain will put strengthening and sustaining that union at its heart. It has always been the special mission of our Conservative Party to be the true national party in Britain, to aspire to represent all of the country and all of the people. And today, our goal must be nothing less, because we are now the party of the new centre ground of British politics. Rejecting the extremes of Labour's socialist left, UKIP's libertarian right, and the divisive and obsessive nationalisms of Plaid Cymru and the SNP. And we've seen that tunnel vision on display again this week. The SNP argue that we should break up the UK because we are leaving the EU. But 3 years ago, they campaigned for a result that would have taken Scotland out of the EU altogether. They're happy to see power rest in Brussels, but if those powers come back to London, they want them given to Edinburgh so they can try and give them back to Brussels. And now they apparently say that an independent Scotland would no longer seek to become a member of the EU after a vote for separation. It's muddle on muddle. The fact that more Scottish voters backed Scotland staying in the UK in 2014 than supported the UK staying in the EU in 2016, and that almost 500,000 independent supporters actually backed Brexit last year, seems to count for nothing. It is now clear that using Brexit as the pretext to engineer a second independence referendum has been the SNP's sole objective ever since last June. But it would be bad for Scotland, bad for the United Kingdom, and bad for us all. The coming negotiations with the EU will be vital for everyone in the United Kingdom. Every person, every family, every business, every community. The length and breadth of the United Kingdom, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. It is essential that we get the right deal and that all of our efforts and energies as a country are focused on that outcome. We can only get that deal if we are united, as one united kingdom, all pulling together to get the best outcome. That's what we've always done when we're faced with challenges. We've pulled together as one and succeeded together. We are four nations, but at heart we are one people. And as the Prime Minister of this United Kingdom, I will always ensure the voices and interests of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are represented as we negotiate to leave the EU. And I will always fight to strengthen and sustain this precious, precious union.
It was the UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking in the Welsh capital Cardiff today at the spring conference for her Conservative Party in Wales. Now, she mentioned there, Jack, the divisive nationalism, she said, of Plaid Cymru and the SNP. Those are, of course, the two parties that are seeking independence for their relevant countries, for Wales and for Scotland. Was this speech not a nationalist speech?
By her own admission, it was a nationalist speech. She said during the speech that she wanted the Conservative Party to be the national party and, you know, this great country. She was referring to us as being one people. You know, we are four different nations, but we are one people. We must keep this precious union together. We must pull it together, which, of course, is odd in itself because she's simultaneously saying that we are not one people with the rest of Europe and that pulling together is a wonderful thing when we are the four nations of the United Kingdom, but not when we're the European Union. I'm not claiming that she's right or wrong on those things, but those two points are obviously do contradict one another. Now, and a very quick point that is often made with regards to the Scottish issue, which she was talking about there, and she talked about it as well, about this idea that there is a contradiction in terms between Scottish independence and wanting to stay as a part of the European Union. I saw it put quite well the other day, and the way it was put was, imagine if Theresa May, David Cameron as it was, had to go to the European Union to ask permission to hold the Brexit referendum. Imagine that situation. Mm-hmm. And that tells you everything about why the European Union and the Union of the United Kingdom are two very, very different things.
Mm-hmm. No, I saw that as well. I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. And we are no strangers in Scotland to having debates about what nationalism is as well. I mean, in 2014, if you were a yes voter, you were just called a nationalist, and that was just seen as being, you know, the two were synonymous. You were a nationalist. Though during the Brexit referendum, we didn't really see as many of those who were voting to leave the EU being branded as nationalists.
Well, the Brexit referendum was a strange one because it had a lot more support within the media at large. The Scottish independence referendum famously was not. It was, the media was much more hostile towards it. Perhaps in a perfectly natural way, in a way that you might have expected towards Brexit, in that it was a challenge to the status quo and that the media would question that, obviously. It didn't seem to do that to quite the same extent with Brexit. There were several newspapers that were supportive of a Leave vote, and it certainly seemed as though they had a bit more of prominence and a bit more legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the government in the UK had people within its ranks who were pro leaving the European Union.
Well, I'm sure they'll be discussing more of this over the next
few
weeks.
Maybe, I'm not sure if it'll come up again. So that could be the last we'll hear of it.
I seem to say that almost every day now. I'm sure we'll be coming back to this.
There's nothing more to say about Brexit or Scotland.
Well, for now anyway, thank you, Jack. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, a controversial new piece of legislation is due to be rolled out across the UK next month without having been voted on in Parliament or subjected to parliamentary scrutiny. The legislation will require women who have conceived a child via rape to prove that they were raped in order to gain access to benefits. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Hey, Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day right here on Radio Sputnik.
On Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not, you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy!
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, a controversial new piece of legislation is due to be rolled out across the United Kingdom next month without having been voted on in Parliament or subjected to parliamentary scrutiny. The legislation will require women who have conceived the child via rape to prove that they were raped in order to gain access to benefits. An attack on a French school in the southeast of France has once again raised concerns about the availability of guns and explosives in the country. But as a state of emergency continues, should more be done to psychologically profile potential attackers? And it's St. Patrick's Day. We'll be looking at some things you might not know about the Irish holiday. It's 21 minutes past the hour. This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik with me, Carolyn Scott. Now, the UK's Conservative government has put in place controversial new legislation without any debate or vote in Parliament. Bypassing the Parliament, the government's so-called rape clause was added to legislation late on Wednesday as an amendment to an existing act, and the scheme will come into effect in 1 month's time. The controversial policy relates to the claiming of tax credits for families with more than two children. In attempts to cut public spending, the government initially announced in October 2015 that benefits would not be extended to a third child unless a mother can prove that the child was conceived via rape. Alison Thewlis, a Scottish National Party MP, has consistently argued against this legislation, and this week led an angry response to what is seen as the sneaking through of legislation, stating that it was, quote, an underhand parliamentary tactic to introduce the legislation without a vote and proper parliamentary scrutiny. Here she is questioning the Prime Minister Theresa May about the legislation in the House of Commons back in October.
I've been asking questions for 15 months now on this Tory government's appalling two-child policy and rape clause. The government still doesn't know how it will work. From one feminist to another, can the Prime Minister tell me how she justifies putting vulnerable women through the trauma of proving their third child has been born as a result of rape?
Well, Prime Minister.
Honourable Lady, we've been very clear that women who have a third child as a result of rape would not be subject to the limit that is being considered in relation to the benefits. We are considering this. I absolutely recognise that the Honourable Lady is making a point about the concern about how this will be dealt with in terms of dealing with individuals who have been through that trauma of rape. That's why the government is taking its time, is considering this and is consulting on this at the moment and looking at how we can ensure that we do this in absolutely the right way.
That was Alison Thewlis, an SNP MP, and the Prime Minister Theresa May during Prime Minister's Questions last year. And joining me to discuss this further is Sarah Green, the co-director of End Violence Against Women. Now, Sarah, thank you for your time today. Firstly, do you believe that it's ever appropriate for government legislation to come into effect that requires women to prove they were raped in order to access benefits?
No, this is an appalling proposal from the first day it emerged. The government has come up with this because it's trying to cut back on the, you know, the spending bill around welfare payments. But it has created a real problem when it has tried to create an incentive or controls around how many children families choose to have. And that is an inherent problem because women do not always have complete control over that and may be in multiple difficult situations with making decisions about family planning. So it's obvious once the proposal was announced that it's going to be very difficult for women who are in long-term abusive relationships, including where there's bullying and control. It's also very difficult where a woman has suffered sexual violence in the past or is still currently with somebody who abuses her in that way. And what the government has come up with is a kind of compromise where it's saying that a trusted third party can take a woman's appeal and take her evidence that she's been raped. But really, the idea of evidencing rape with a stranger is an avenue we should never be thinking about going down.
Mm-hmm. And just how much emotional stress is this likely to cause for women who have been victims of rape?
I think it's very difficult for survivors of rape because it's going to indicate that this is something you must prove. If you have any doubt about yourself, which many survivors of rape do, then it's going to be up to somebody else to decide whether this happened to you. And it's also asking in some cases for other kinds of evidence, like some of the people who would inspect whether a rape happened, so-called, might be looking at things like conception dates for particular children. The proposal is not very thoughtful, for example, in talking about a third child and subsequent children, when for some women their earlier children might have been created as with a conception that wasn't consensual. And the whole idea is very, very problematic and insulting and possibly re-traumatizing for women. And it is extremely disappointing that it was also pushed through Parliament in this way that didn't require a full debate.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a moment ago the impact on people in long-term abusive relationships. Now, I believe that if you are in a long-term abusive relationship, and even if you can prove that a child has been conceived via by rape, if you stay with the partner, you're no longer gain that exemption. Is that correct? And just how damaging could that be to trying to actually help women leave abusive relationships?
That is correct. So if a woman is still in a relationship with a man who she says is raped her and which leading to a conception of one of their children, she's not eligible for this tax credit exemption, which is about, you know, filling in forms and talking to strangers. The reason that the government created that part of these rules is because it didn't want to be seen to reward or the perpetrator. It shows, again, a failure to understand the circumstances that some women are living in, and it's extremely disappointing.
Mm-hmm. And the government say that those seeking to claim the exemption for rape will be assessed by what they say is a professional third party. Now, do we know about who these people will be and how the assessments will be carried out and what training they might get?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a list of people who might be these third parties, and they include, for example, the police and health workers, other social workers, I think. And it also talks about charities that provide, for example, counselling for rape survivors. What is problematic about many of those is that, for a start, with the police, the vast majority of women who are raped don't ever report to the police. We've got reported rates of about 15%, perhaps, at a best guess. For others of those frontline public service workers, you are talking about strangers, often, to women who are not necessarily the people that they would want to disclose a rape to or that they disclosed it to at the time. And there's going to be questions about what will you think of me and will you doubt me if I tell you this in order to access the tax credits I should be able to get. With the rape charities, the counselling charities, they are put in an extremely difficult position by telling them, by bringing them into a process where they are certifying someone's eligibility for benefits. So on every level, those third parties are problematic and difficult for women to access. And furthermore, at this point, the proposal actually, it rolls out in April. These rules start and become real from April. And there hasn't, to our knowledge, and as reported in the press, been any kind of training or consideration with those kinds of third-party people as to what it actually means when you take evidence and certify that somebody is an eligible rape survivor.
Mm-hmm. And just finally, is it not quite likely that many women who have been victims of rape will just forfeit the benefit altogether rather than put themselves through this process?
That's very likely. It is very likely that women won't access this, which kind of tells a story about the whole reform.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your time today. It's lovely to have you on the show.
You're welcome.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 30 minutes past the hour. A shooting at a school in the southeast town of Grasse sent shockwaves throughout France yesterday. A 16-year-old suspect is being held in connection with the gun and grenade attack. But could greater gun control and psychological profiling prevent future attacks of this kind from occurring again? Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
Police and emergency services rushed to the Alexis de Tocqueville High School in Grasse, southeast France. A 16-year-old attacker opened fire on three pupils and a teacher, firing a rifle and two handguns before lobbing grenades into the school premises. Another 10 pupils were injured in a stampede as they tried to flee the gun attack. A police intervention unit was quickly on the scene and managed to apprehend the suspect, who was later described by authorities as mentally unstable and obsessed with the notorious US Columbine High School massacre in 1999. The incident has caused more alarm throughout France, which remains in a state of emergency following a series of high-profile terrorist attacks. But French police told news agencies they didn't consider the attack a terrorist incident, adding that the weapons used in the attack had belonged to the boy's parents and grandfather. US-style mass shootings are rare in France, a country which has low levels of gun crime. But the incident is bound to lead to questions about the ease to which the Grasse attacker managed to obtain such weapons and carry out his attack. French investigators were already looking into how attackers who carried out the attacks in Paris in 2015 were able to obtain assault rifles and explosive suicide vests. The attack in Grasse may also prompt authorities to look again at French gun laws and identify any possible weaknesses that may need to be addressed. Well, to discuss this case in a little more detail, I'm now joined by Peter Squires, Professor of Criminology and Public Policy at the University of Brighton. Professor Squires, mass school shootings are nothing new and are not confined to France or the US. Why do you think schools have tended to be specifically targeted in this way, as opposed to other locations where you might expect to find large numbers of people?
I think with the large numbers of these shootings, particularly in the States, I think there's a certain kind of copycat effect kicking in. It's become a way of young people venting their dissatisfactions. Of course, they have to have access to firearms. You can't take that element out of it. But I think looking at the pattern of these sorts of events, which often include presentations on Facebook or other social media, young people who are alienated or frustrated or have broken up with girlfriends, and they take this awful revenge on the school, which they see as, if you like, the source of all their problems.
And would introducing psychological profiling, particularly in relation to gun control, would that help reduce the number of attacks?
I think it's kind of a long shot. I think the trouble with psychological profiling is that you're looking at an age group, adolescents, who are going through an awful lot of social changes, and we know all about the storm and stress of adolescence. It's also the age at which the kind of peak age for offending occurs. So young people are going through a lot of changes at these times. They're difficult years. So psychologically profiling people to say, are they likely to commit an atrocity of this nature? I think it's such a rare event, in fact, you'd produce thousands of false positives. You'd be suggesting far too many people would be doing it. I think there's a link with guns, but I think some of the practice in the States, where they have early warners, a bit like suicide watch people in prisons, where people are keeping an ear to the ground and looking to pick up kids who are perhaps showing signs of anger and frustration.
And there's some indication that the alleged perpetrator in this case may have had psychological issues, but is it necessarily true that's the case in every attack of this nature?
It's certainly not true of every kid that does this, but there's certainly a kind of emerging profile of a young person who is often a loner within their own peer group. They're often often victims of bullying, and so in a sense, getting a gun to enact a kind of revenge is a way of them reasserting their power through lethal means and through firearms. And in a way, you could say that's also a very American solution to the problem of feeling bullied and powerless. But often there are elements of homophobia, misogynistic tendencies, and often elements of racism. Looking at who often gets shot, young men are often shooting young women in these school shootings, and I think that's often a hidden aspect of it. Often they're shooting girls, or the kind of girls that have jilted them, and for whom they blame for their own predicaments.
And in terms of the psychology of the perpetrator, how do these attacks differ from those carried out by terrorists?
Well, I think the terrorists are fighting a particular kind of ideological cause. In the great scheme of things, you can say that a mass attack is a mass attack. It's picking on a soft and vulnerable target. But I think in the case of terror attacks, what we're seeing is this resort, particularly in Paris, Belgium, resort to mass casualty weapons. And I know the current attacker had, I think, two handguns. But we're not talking about machine guns, which is what terrorists have tended to get access to. I think the school attacks are far more personalised. They're the attacks of introverted people trying to assert themselves and avenge themselves on an environment they feel has let them down or has jilted them. Whereas the terror attacks are attempts to provoke the security state into excessive responses to justify their own narrative about social exclusion and ideological oppression.
And can you describe what the psychological impact is on victims who survive attacks like this? And do perpetrators ever deliberately aim to cause psychological harm to their victims, short of killing them, when they carry out these attacks?
I think all of the above applies. I think certainly some of the stories that have come out of previous shootings of shooters taunting them, threatening them, shooting them, going away, coming back to see if they're dead. I think that tells a story of very damaged people trying to exercise a kind of power by torture, if you like. And the consequences of this are enormous. People are in what are supposed to be safe environments, you know. And I think there's also an element of that. Why are schools chosen? I think schools are chosen because they are where the young people are. But at the same time, it's saying something about the vulnerability of society, the vulnerability of the kind of systems of order we depend on. If we cannot even make schools safe places, we cannot make anywhere a safe space. So I think it's attacking a culture at its most precious and vulnerable point.
And what clues should authorities be looking at to try and identify potential perpetrators? I appreciate it could be a hugely challenging task, but is there anything obvious they could be looking at?
Well, the knee-jerk reaction in many American schools was to go for a kind of target hardening response, whereby they installed metal detectors at school entrances and brought a kind of clamp-down form of discipline on the young people. I mean, that response, although popular, turning schools into fortresses, I don't think is a long-term sustainable solution. I think it's all about addressing the culture of competitiveness. In a number of the schools, it was about the hidden cultures of bullying that teachers hadn't really taken full responsibility for. It was often about homophobic and misogynistic cultures within the school groups. And that's why they needed to have more effective listening systems, so that these tensions, if you like, these intolerances could be nipped in the bud before someone decided to bring a knife or a gun into the class.
And France is in an ongoing state of emergency at the moment. How much do the authorities rely on the psychology of potential perpetrators, and where does that fit into their general intelligence gathering effort?
Well, I'd be surprised if at this stage, other than their profiling of known active terror group members, I would be surprised if the levels of intelligence percolated down as far as disaffected pupils, because there are clearly too many of them to do that effectively. I mean, that was my point earlier about false positives. If you discover that half a generation and maybe half a cohort of a particular racial group is at risk, you've created a bigger problem than you could even begin to start servicing. So I'd be surprised if psychological profiling was much use at this stage. I think there are all sorts of issues about tackling firearm access to firearms, and especially access to criminal firearms. France has got a significant problem in that regard. But otherwise, I think the best ways of dealing with these issues are often what are sometimes referred to as the soft controls, the informal intelligences that people have and develop through networks and peer groups, so that people are keeping their ear to the ground and really looking out for one another.
And finally, beyond the access to guns and weapons, how significant a role does modern Western culture play in these kinds of attacks, where guns and violence are often glorified in movies and in certain genres of music?
I think you're absolutely right. And to talk particularly about the kind of online active shooter video games, where people can become very adept at shooting lots of people very quickly, I think even the US military have in the past regarded that as almost a kind of process of teaching kids to kill. So I think culture has some responsibility here, but generally speaking, the kids who do these atrocity actions and the kids who don't are all watching the same videos, films, listening to the same gangster rap music as one another. I think it's something about the young people. I don't think you can say culture is a causal factor, but it's certainly suggesting to some perhaps highly suggestible young people, or very marginalized young people, or young people with a limited grasp of reality, it's certainly suggesting to them ways of resolving their bullying or their disaffection difficulties in their school and in their peer groups. But, and this is the thing, not everybody resorts to this, even though, as you've suggested, it is often the plot of every gangster film, every Hollywood Western that you can ever imagine. Man solves problem by picking up gun, killing person who has threatened him. I mean, that's the narrative of every sort of popular crime film that's come out of Hollywood.
Professor Squires, fascinating insight there. Thank you very much for joining us on World in Focus.
No problem at all.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, we'll be looking at comments made by a left-wing challenger to the Hungarian presidency, who hit out at Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister, stating that the election of Trump and the UK's Brexit vote have emboldened the right-wing leader and caused a rise in authoritarian rule to the detriment of democracy. That's in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Hungary re-elected their right-wing president this week, a member of the ruling party. But the left-wing presidential candidate has hit out at Prime Minister Viktor Orban, stating that the election of Trump and the UK's Brexit vote have emboldened the right-wing leader and caused a rise in authoritarian rule to the detriment of democracy. And it is, of course, St. Patrick's Day, and we'll be looking at some things you might not know about the Irish holiday. On Monday, Hungary voted to re-elect President János Éder, a member of the right-wing governing Fidesz party, as Hungary's president. The election was not surprising, given the strength of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's party in the Hungarian parliament. But speaking to the UK newspaper The Guardian this week, László Moytonyi, the left-wing candidate who stood against Éder, stated that the election of Donald Trump and the UK's vote to leave the European Union had weakened democracy in Hungary. Moytonyi said, quote, "I think it's much worse compared with the people of the United States because I'm sure that civil society and democracy in the United States is extremely strong, but the new American administration is a threat to democracy in Baltic countries and not very good news for the Hungarian people," end quote. He also added that Britain's Brexit vote had had similar impact on democratic forces, strengthening what he called the authoritarian leaders like Hungary's Viktor Orban. Orban was the only European leader to openly back Donald Trump as a candidate in the US elections and has come under fire across the EU for refusing to adhere to EU norms and for the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers arriving in Hungary, which is now part of a major investigation by human rights groups. Earlier in the week, I spoke to Dr. Miklós Sándor, the director of the right-wing think tank, the Centre for Fundamental Rights in Hungary, about Moytonyi's comments. Dr. Sándor Moytonyi said some things about the impact events around the world had had on Hungarian politics. He said that Trump's election and Brexit vote had threatened authoritarian rule and weakened democracy and civil society. What do you make of those comments?
Let's make it clear, first of all, that despite any other older popular domestic or international concerns, democracy, including, of course, fundamental rights, still exists and functions in Hungary fully and clearly. As, for example, the core and basic element of a democracy, the constitution, namely the new fundamental law of Hungary, was adopted a few years ago in line with the democratic standards by a democratically elected parliament in a legitimate manner and in a transparent legal lawmaking procedure. The division of powers is also guaranteed in the fundamental law as well, and in everyday life as well, and of course, free elections are guaranteed in every fourth or fifth year. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly is also guaranteed in Hungary as anti-governmental protests take place on a daily or weekly basis. The problem of Mr. Moytonyi, the presidential candidate, is a concern regarding the phenomenon of rising of conservative or populist center-right parties or center-right figures. It is true that there is a change also on the domestic level in Hungary, but of course on the European level and on the global or Western level as well, as new and honest politicians or political forces emerge on the political landscape, contrary to the liberal mainstream. That is true. So, for example, the problem of Mr. Moytonyi in the reality is not the allegations regarding anti-democratic tendencies in Hungary, but his problem is the fact that the center-right government is in power, promoting conservative values like the traditional role of family or the Christian heritage of Hungary.
We have seen Orban being bolstered. He's been emboldened by the Brexit vote. He's been emboldened by the election of Donald Trump. And it does seem that he is taking now a much stronger stance in just ignoring many EU norms.
It's not about ignoring EU norms. It's about facing reality. So, for example, just take the example of the Hungarian measures regarding defending the Hungarian state and Hungarian citizens against the mass migration and defending the Hungarian borders. A few years ago, it was labeled as some kind of extraordinary or even anti-democratic policy. And nowadays, what we see on the European level is that from Germany to Austria and to France, many politicians applaud the defense or defending the borders of the European Union and defending the borders of Hungary. So what I see that the that Mr. Orbán has some kind of capability not to see in the future, but to adapt to reality. And for example, he was the first among EU leaders or EU member state leaders who declared that the existing mass migration is not a good tendency, and contrary to the liberal mainstream, a sovereign state has the right to defend its borders. And nowadays, what I see on the level of EU policies, it can become an EU norm. So Mr. Orbán has the ability to change even EU norms or EU policies.
Just looking at the situation in Hungary right now, it seems that Orbán is very strong. Is there actually a solid opposition anywhere in Hungary standing up against Orbán right now? Do they have any solid opposition figures?
To tell the truth, due to the infamous lie speech of the previous socialist prime minister, Mr. Ferenc Gyurcsány, and after the massive and very brutal terror attacks, police attacks, sorry, against peaceful demonstrators of Fidesz in 2006. After this situation, the Hungarian left and leftist liberal parties lose their popular support in Hungary, and they were not capable of regaining it, nor in 2010 and nor in 2014. And nowadays, what we see that there is a quite strong center-right governing alliance of Fidesz and Christian Democrats. There is a not so strong but still second in the polls far-right radical party called Jobbik, and the Hungarian Socialist Party, the leading force of the Hungarian leftist political bloc in the 90s and in the beginning of the 2000s. Is just the third most popular party. So the Hungarian opposition is very, very divided. And in within the Hungarian opposition, the Hungarian left is also very divided. There are four or five small or medium parties sharing the same votes and sharing the same political idea, but in different political base, and they have no picture or story about Hungary, how they would rebuild or build the country in the future. Their only message is that we are against the so-called Orbán regime, but on the other hand, there is no story about their Hungary picture.
And is it not, just finally, is it not quite fundamental to a functioning democracy for there to be a strong opposition?
Yeah, but it's up to the opposition. So it's not up to the government to create an opposition for itself, but in every country it's up to the opposition to find the good stories, to find the good policies, to find the way to reach out to the voters. But the Hungarian leftist and radical right opposition is not capable for this at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Santo, thank you very much for joining us on World in Focus.
This is Radio Sputnik.
And finally, on this St. Patrick's Day, Jack and I have challenged each other to come up with interesting facts about St. Patrick's Day. And I'm going to go first, Jack.
Okay.
Go on for you.
St.
Patrick was an Irish. Now, quite a few people know this fact. He was born in Britain around 390 But he was kidnapped by Irish pirates at the age of 16 and taken to Ireland to work as a shepherd.
As you say, Carolyn, a lot of people do know that, so I'm going to say that's a rubbish fact to start with.
It's a big one.
I'm going to better you. One of the more famous things about St. Patrick is that he banished the snakes from Ireland.
Was it not with a flute or something?
I think you're mixing them up with the Pied Piper of Hamelin there. But according to fossil evidence, there were never, ever any snakes on Ireland. So.
Wow, that is a good fact. But for 67 years, between 1903 and 1970, St. Patrick's Day was classed as a religious holiday, and in Ireland, pubs were shut.
How did that work?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, fair enough, that's quite a good fact. Yeah. Did you know, though, Carolyn, that the colour associated with St. Patrick was not green back in the day, it was blue? Green was unlucky, and St. Patrick's blue was symbolic of Ireland for hundreds of years, and that is why the Irish presidential standard, as you well know, Carolyn, is still blue.
I actually did not know that at all.
Have you got one more fact?
Very quickly, traditionally every year the Irish Taoiseach, that's the Prime Minister, gives a crystal bowl of shamrocks to the US President, and indeed he did today. They're grown in Kerry. The shamrocks are then immediately destroyed by the Secret Service after the exchange.
That's a bit harsh.
It is a bit harsh. Unfortunately, that's all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. You can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh until Monday from me, Carolyn Scott.
And me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye.
Mine's a Guinness.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Catch all the breaking global political and economic news as it happens. Sputnik brings an all-star lineup with expert opinion from some of the biggest names in the news today. Noam Chomsky.
Turkey, U.S. ally, their main goal is to attack the Kurds, the one ground force opposing ISIS. And there have been a kind of a funnel for support of ISIS, not officially, but in practice.
Peter Sunday, co-founder of the Pirate Bay.
We don't have any sort of democratic control over the internet. And I think that we're very naive when we think that the internet itself is intrinsically good. It's not. It's just a very neutral technology that is being used for good things, but more and more being used for evil things.
Icelandic Foreign Minister Gunnar Bragi Sveinsson.
We increased activities in the Keflavik Air Base, and that has to do with more activities from the Russian Northern Fleet in the ocean around Iceland, and also, of course, these usual flights of the bombers.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
We're the ones that destroyed the government of Libya. We're the ones in a pipeline dispute that helped destroy the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We're the ones who invaded Iraq.
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry.
The hostile relationship between the United States and Russia today is dangerous for both countries, not because either country would actually want to start a military conflict, but because there's always a danger of blundering.
Sputnik talks to the brightest minds in politics and current affairs to find out what's really happening. Tune in.